everybody. Welcome to episode 581 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is your Marvel Monday episode for the week, and I'm going to be talking about a few of the titles that came out last Wednesday, October 31st, as far as Marvel is concerned. And there's four books I'm going to talk about. One of them actually is continuing the Charles Soule run of Daredevil that we've been recapping over the last few episodes. So that'll be issue 7 of that run. And the other three are titles that came out recently. So let's start with the X-Men Black White Queen, or X-Men Black Emma Frost, I should say, issue. It's written by Leah Williams. Pencils by Chris Boccolo. A lot of inkers here. We've got Faulker, Vey, Livesay, Townsend, Mendoza, and Boccolo himself. Colors are from Antonio Fabella, Dan Brown, Carlos Lopez, and again, Chris Boccolo. And we've got VC's Corey Petit on letters. So first, just a mention on the art. You know, I'm used to Chris Boccolo's art being really well done, just gorgeous to look at, and this is less so. It just feels not quite as polished or as finished as his art typically looks, and it's got to be because there's so many different people that have a hand in the issue. It just doesn't really seem to flow. I will say, for the number of people that are on the issue that have a hand in art, that it does look relatively consistent. But unfortunately, it's not super high quality consistency. So as far as the story itself, there's not a lot to recap here. It starts off with White Queen meeting the X-Men at a kind of a big box store, if you will, the equivalent of a Walmart. And she's asking the X-Men for their help in taking out the Hellfire Club once and for all. And after a little bit of a consultation, the X-Men agree, and they all split up and go after various members of the Hellfire Club themselves, whereas Emma Frost goes after Sebastian Shaw himself, the Black King. While unbeknownst to the X-Men, this is all part of a coup that the White Queen has been planning for a long time. And once she takes out Sebastian Shaw, she takes over as the Black King herself and lets the X-Men know by having baskets delivered to them at the moment they have vanquished some of the other members of the Hellfire Club. So it's Emma being Emma, you could say. You know, she's, I won't say two-faced, but she has her own agenda. And the X-Men, despite their maybe misgivings, go ahead and go along because they believe that wiping out the Hellfire Club will benefit them as well. But of course, what they're not counting on is that Emma already has people in mind to take over for these members of the Hellfire Club that are finally taken out once and for all. And who she has in mind to take over as the new leader of the Hellfire Club obviously is herself. So, you know, Emma, it's been an interesting journey for Emma Frost. You know, obviously introduced as the White Queen and a powerful member of the Hellfire Club for a long time, but, you know, never its true leader, but yet always maybe having that ambition to be a leader. And at various times working more closely with the X-Men, even to the point of being on the team for a while, being a teacher at the academy. And you just, I don't know that she ever fully became trustworthy in my mind. Right. I mean, there were some interesting stories and the whole thing with her and Cyclops having a psychic affair. You know, there were always just enough clues with Emma that you, at least I felt like you could never fully trust her. So this is almost her going completely back to her old ways of being treacherous, untrustworthy, and looking out for herself, which, you know, putting herself first was probably always part of her character, I don't know that that has ever changed. So I like that Leia Williams, first of all, I know that one of Leia's favorite characters is Emma Frost, the White Queen. So, and I love that Leia kind of has this story of Emma being completely unapologetic about who she is, you know, completely unrepentant. She's not one to put on airs. You know, she goes after what she wants. Again, that ambition, that drive, that self-centeredness, which are all integral to the White Queen's nature. So I love that, that Leia embraces that. And, you know, the White Queen is an incredible villain in my mind. Because she lives in that gray area that makes her interesting and makes her relatable. And I think that Leia Williams in this story is really embracing that. So it's nice to hear a writer say, yeah, I love the White Queen. She's one of my favorite characters, but not try to make her anything more than what she is, you know, try to speak to the heroic nature of her, but rather swing the other way and say, no, this is the new status quo. She's in it for herself 100%, and she is the new Black King. So I really enjoyed this this issue from a story perspective. I do wish the art was a little better, because unfortunately it's not great. Also, we've got the conclusion of the, I think it's a 5-part story of about Apocalypse by Zach Thompson and Lonnie Nadler in the back. I haven't read all the X-Men Black issues, so I didn't read all the backup stories with Apocalypse, because once I think I read the first one, because I read X-Men Black Magneto, but then I think I skipped, and like I didn't read Mojo. I think I read Juggernaut, because I talked about it last week. So I think I read like 1, 4, and 5. So I didn't follow the Apocalypse story, because again it wouldn't have made sense since I missed a couple chapters there. So I may have to go back and dig those up and see if I can read the Apocalypse story at a later date. And if I do, I'll be sure and let you guys know what I think. All right, let's move on to the next issue. This is another Leia Williams written issue with another female X-Men character. So it's What If Magic Became Sorcerer Supreme. It's written by the aforementioned Leia Williams. We've got art by Felipe Andrade, colors by Chris O'Halloran, letters by VC's Clayton Cowles. So for those that are not familiar, the What If is a series, a classic series that Marvel's done several times over the years. And it postulates a question like, what if something different happened than what actually happened in the normal timeline of the Marvel universe? So, you know, what if Flash Thompson became Spider-Man instead of Peter Parker? What if Captain America didn't get found by Submariner? You know, things like that. So this question that Leia is attempting to answer, and the rest of the creative team, is what if Illyana, instead of escaping what if instead of coming back mere seconds after she was pulled into the limbo dimension by Belasco, even so she was in, maybe I should give background first. So Illyana Rasputin, Colossus's little sister, is taken by a demonic sorcerer named Belasco. And she's taken to his dimension limbo, where he trains her as a kind of a dark sorceress. And she eventually escapes from him when her own mutant powers appear. And so she is able to create these teleportation discs. And once that power manifests itself, she's able to escape from limbo, and she comes back right where she left off. So mere seconds pass on Earth, but she comes back having 7 years of her life spent in limbo. So she leaves as a small child. She comes back seconds later to the X-Men, and she's a teenager, even though 7 years have passed in her life, only seconds have passed on Earth. So she eventually has this dark child persona that manifests itself from time to time. It's that inner part of her that has wielded dark magic, and it's something that she fights against her whole life. So she becomes a member of the New Mutants and eventually a member of the X-Men, and she has a long, you know, history with X-Men. She's been around for a long, long time. So what this story postulates is, what if all that happened as it did, but instead of staying with the New Mutants, what if that fear of what she learned there, that fear of having this dark child persona, this darkness inside of her, forced her to run away from the X-Men, to leave these people that she considers her friends and family, because she's worried that this darkness inside of her will eventually harm them. So that's the story that Leah and company are telling here. So what happens is she's hitchhiking up and down the East Coast, and eventually she encounters Doctor Strange, because she's such a powerful sorceress that he senses her presence. So she's 15 years old. She encounters Doctor Strange. They fight. And eventually Doctor Strange is able to transport Ileana to his Sanctum Sanctorum. And once she gets inside there with all the wards and spells of protection, everything that Doctor Strange has on the Sanctum, every time Ileana tries to create one of her teleportation discs and go through it, she ends up right where she started, to the point where Ileana realizes she's trapped and tells Doctor Strange, "You think you're the first sorcerer to trap me in his home?" And Strange is like, "All I want you to do is stay for lunch. You know, you have that pitiful, underfed, runaway pallor to you." So she agrees to stay for lunch. They start talking. She explains what she has been through with Belasco and learning learning this evil magic. And Strange, for his part, explains why he brought her there, and eventually offers her to become his apprentice. He wants to teach her how to be the next sorceress supreme. And that doesn't go over well, the initial offer of that. And she's like, "You just heard that a madman, kidnapped me, imprisoned me in his home, and wanted to make me his apprentice. And you learn about that on the day that we met, and you offer me the same thing. What did you think I was going to do?" As she's kind of freaking out. And Strange is like, I hadn't considered that. And as a show of good faith, he opens the front door and allows her to leave, but walks along with her and explains about the potential he sees in her, how powerful of a sorceress she can be. And Ileana, for her part, is talking about, "No one does anything, 100% out of the goodness of their heart. You know, kind of what's in it for you?" And Strange is like, you're right. And I'll be totally honest with you. I want to retire as Sorcerer Supreme. I'm tired. And that's part of the reason that I want to train you as Sorcerer Supreme. So she spends a few years, or at least a year, under Doctor Strange's tutelage here, because as the story progresses, she turns 16, and there's always one part of a training to be a sorcerer that she can't quite master. And when she finally does, it brings her face to face with Belasco again, and you'll have to read it yourself to find out exactly what happens there. But suffice it to say that it just like Leah captures the White Queen so perfectly, she really captures the heroic side of Ileana Rasputin here, despite anything that Belasco taught her, any influence he might have had on her, any dark part of her soul that he has managed to nurture. Her heroic side really kind of wins out in the end, And it's a really, really great story. I feel like at the end, there's one of those moments where you're just like, hell yeah. You know, again, just like Leah gets who Emma Frost is, she really gets who Ilyana is. And I've never been a giant fan of Ilyana. I've been kind of indifferent toward her. But I will say that this story made me like her a lot more. And I would read an Ilyana title that was set in this universe with her training to become Sorceress Supreme. I think it's an excellent story. And it was so well done. Leah gives such a great voice. It feels the voice that Leah gives to Ilyana feels so authentic, more so than anyone that I've ever any other writer I've ever read writing Ilyana. And I think that's part of the reason why I enjoyed it so much. It's insight into Ilyana and this dark part of her soul, and kind of we get to see her thought process and what she thinks of herself, and we get to also see it through the lens of Doctor Strange, who's maybe one of the wisest characters in the Marvel Universe. So that helps us understand, you know, like we're getting firsthand from Ilyana what she feels, but we're also getting Doctor Strange almost translating it for us in a way, like putting it in the terms of how he sees it, which makes a lot of sense. And that's why I feel like the voice feels so authentic. So a great job by Leah on this character. Like I said, I would definitely read a series that was set in this universe that told more stories of Ilyana on her journey to become Sorceress Supreme. As far as the art, it's not quite as clean or as polished of an art style as I would like from Felipe Andrade, but it is very suitable for the story that Leah is telling. He handles kind of the mysticism very well. But I think where the art shines the most is in the color work. I think the color work on this issue is handled extremely well by Chris O'Halloran. So I wanted to be sure to point that out. All right, next book I'm going to mention just really briefly. I'm not going to give a synopsis, but I did read Iron Man number 5 from last week as well. And this is from writer Dan Slott with art by Max Dunbar and Gang Huoc Lim. And we've got color art by Dono Sanchez Almara. The art is really good, actually. It's very fine lines and great storytelling from panel to panel. Really, really like the transitions. And it's a story of Arno Stark, who is Tony Stark's long-lost brother, so to speak. You know, that Brian Michael Bendis a couple years ago, you know, changed around who Tony Stark's biological mother was and introduced this before then heretofore unknown brother of Tony Stark, Arno Stark. And Arno's an interesting character, and I did enjoy this issue. I think that's a good introduction to Arno, and if readers haven't been following along and they haven't read Iron Man up to this point, but they've jumped on with the Dan Slott run, then again, it's a good intro to Arno Stark. You get a really good understanding of who he is, and some of his backstory and such, and what he does, and a little bit of insight into his relationship with Tony. But what's interesting is he's a very complex character, I'll say. And based on the decisions that he makes and how this issue ends, you wonder how much Tony can trust him. It would be really nice because him and Tony have so many things in common, you know, beyond being brothers and being, you know, genius level intellects, and wanting to help the world and have this altruistic nature. It would be great for Tony to have somebody that close to him that really understood him, right? Tony Stark, and part of this has to do with the way Robert Downey Jr. has portrayed him in the MCU. Tony Stark kind of has a glibness to him now in the Marvel Universe. a kind of a joking side that wasn't necessarily always there. Used to be a bit more serious. It might be nice if Tony had a close enough relationship with Arno that we could still see that side of him, that side of him that's not always cracking jokes and putting on this face for the world of his kind of happy-go-lucky master inventor, right? If we could have this close relationship with the brothers that gave us insight into the more serious side of Tony. But with what happens in this issue, you just wonder how much can Tony trust Arno? What are Arno's intentions? Are they 100% altruistic? Like what is Arno's thought process? Like I said, we get a good understanding of the backstory and some of the things Arno does. I don't know that we fully understand the reasons behind some of the choices that he makes, the choices that are a bit more, for lack of a better word, avenging, or him making choices where he feels like he's doling out justice in a way. And you know, he's certainly not a judge. So who is he to sort of pass sentence on people, so to speak, and make these choices that, can affect so many people's lives. It's interesting. He, like I said, he's a complex character, and I hope to see more of him. But I worry if I find it much more interesting for Tony and Arno to have a relationship like I just described, as opposed to Arno becoming an adversary or a rival of Tony. And it feels like maybe that's where Dan Slott is heading. He's heading somewhere toward a story where he's going to put Tony and Arno at odds. And that story of brothers on different sides of the same conflict is much less interesting to me than a story where they have a really close relationship, and we get to see this other side of Tony Stark that we haven't seen before. All right, now on to Daredevil number 7 from writer Charles Soule. This issue has art by Matteo Bufani and colors by Matt Miller. And again, this is from the Daredevil run that started a few years ago from Charles Soule. This issue is actually from 2016. And it's the second part of the story arc. I talked about six a few episodes ago when Elektra showed back up and basically got in a fight with Daredevil, having a score to settle. And at the end of that issue, issue 6, we find out the whole reason that Elektra has showed up and put Blindspot in the hospital and sort of beating the crap out of Daredevil basically is because she believes Daredevil took Elektra's daughter. And that was kind of the bombshell cliffhanger that issue 6 left on. And so it was kind of shocking, you know, never known Elektra to have had a daughter, and Daredevil felt the same way. So this issue starts off with Daredevil telling Elektra, "You don't have a daughter." And Elektra not exactly reacting the way Daredevil would like, you know, calling him a liar, throwing a sigh at him, and Daredevil, you know, saying, "What is wrong with you?" And realizing just how angry she is, and Daredevil thinking, you know, "I got to defuse this before she kills me." And he drops his billy club to the ground and says, "Daredevil, Elektra, I don't know anything about your daughter, and I won't fight you." And Elektra gives him a flying kick, which she kind of holds up on at the last second, and doesn't give him the full force. Otherwise, he probably would be dead. And he realizes that, and realizes how strange the situation is, and believes that based on Elektra kind of pulling up at the last second, that maybe he has a chance to reason with her. So Daredevil basically says, "Hey, we've fought each other hundreds of times, and you've seen me fight thousands more. Have you ever known me to give up?" No, the answer obviously is no. So it shows Elektra that, hey, I don't want to fight you. I just want to talk to you. That's what Daredevil's trying to say. You know, I might be able to help. So Elektra relents and she says, okay, one false move though and you're done. And starts talking about her daughter, whose name's Iona, and gives a kind of a brief history, extremely brief history of her time in New York prior, 11 years prior, 12 years prior. When she first came to New York, she met Matt Murdock, and you know, they fell in love. And obviously at this point, she doesn't realize that Matt and Daredevil are one and the same, because we don't know how yet, but at the end of Brian Michael Bendis' run, Daredevil and Mark Waid's run, Daredevil's identity was publicly known. And we know when Charles Soule's story starts that Daredevil has somehow erased that knowledge from the public thought. And that's going to come back to bite Daredevil here in just a few pages. But anyway, Elektra's remembering her time and saying, you know, I was here at university, things were less complicated, and then they quickly became very complicated, and I ended up leaving. I went and trained with Stick in China. I was a member of his group, The Chaste. I was pregnant during that time, and Stick didn't care. He trained me anyway. But when Iona was born, I didn't want anything in my life that was dangerous to hurt her, to be a threat to her. So I asked Stick to place her in somewhere where she would be happy and safe, and Stick did. And I didn't even want to know where it was. I wanted her far away from me and just to know she was safe. And now she's not safe anymore. She's been taken, and nothing will be enough for Elektra until Elektra finds her daughter. And so the first reaction that Daredevil has, again, Elektra not knowing that Daredevil is Matt Murdock, but immediately Daredevil starts going over the timeline in his head. Could it be possible that he is the father of this child? And Daredevil he asked straight out. He says, who is Iona's father? And Elektra says, a man, it doesn't matter. If I wanted him to know, he would know. But I wanted Iona to live her own life far away from me and her father. And so, again, that doesn't answer any kind of question in Daredevil's mind. Is Iona, is this missing girl his daughter? So the next obvious question for Daredevil is, so what made you think that I had anything to do with her disappearance? And Elektra says, let me show you. And she pulls out a phone and says that there's a video of Iona being trained in the techniques of the hand, which I'm sure you'll recognize. And you are there in this video watching her, supervising her. There's no sound, but you're there. Shows the phone to Matt. Obviously, he can't see it, right? He's Daredevil and he's blind. But again, this if the knowledge that Matt Murdock and Daredevil weren't one and the same wasn't taken from Elektra, she would know that. And Daredevil could talk to her like, hey, I can't see this video. It's on a cell phone. It's nothing to me. So instead, he has to take the phone and he takes it to the one person who still knows his secret, which is Foggy Nelson. And they have the conversation. Matt's like, I'm sorry to have to bring this to you, but there's a child involved. We need to save her. And Foggy's like, who's the father? And, you know, Matt's like, it could be me. I don't know. We'll see. What's important is to find her and make sure she's safe. And Foggy says, hey, you know, I understand. I will help you. But he doesn't pass up the opportunity to jab at Matt a little. He's not happy. Foggy's not happy. We saw that in the first issue that he's the only one that knows, and Matt has kind of manipulated things and put his own needs ahead of Foggy and others. And Foggy calls him on it. He's like, hey, you know, if you didn't make everybody forget their memories, Elektra would know that you're blind and you wouldn't need me to involve me at all. It seems like the more secrets you keep, the harder things get. And then Foggy says, okay, you know, he relents and says, you know, if this child's really in danger, I hope you find her. And Matt's like, what do you mean really in danger? What are you talking about? And that's when Foggy drops the bombshell. Well, I don't know if someone's playing you, or maybe it's Elektra herself, but the phone's empty. There's no video on it. There's nothing to see here. And so Matt leaves and thinks that doesn't make any sense. Why would Elektra lie to him? She's smart, but a long con, like, and based on her reactions and her heartbeats, everything she believed was real. And so Matt doesn't believe that she could have faked that, not that kind of reaction, not at that level. And so in his anger and frustration, he breaks the phone and thinks, you know, my daughter could be out there, someone I'm responsible for. And it just doesn't make sense to him, but it does trigger something in him, thinking about someone he's responsible for. And he calls the night nurse to check in on Blind Spot, who we saw last issue had his arm broken by Elektra. And he seems to be recovering pretty well, but he's going to be out of commission for a little while as Blind Spot. But as Blind Spot doesn't know Matt Murdock and Daredevil are one and the same either, Matt tells him, hey, head down to the DA's office. I have a friend down there who may be able to get you a job, and at least till you're back on your feet, help kind of pay the rent, so to speak. So meanwhile, Matt has called Elektra to tell her what he found out. And when he tells her the phone's empty, she really doesn't take it well, I'll put it that way. And Daredevil again, you know, he's holding his hands up in surrender, saying, look, I know you think that your daughter's in danger, but this is some kind of trick, and the one piece of evidence that we had was destroyed. And even though I knew how you would react to that news, I came here to tell you anyway, and that's kind of my proof that I'm on your side. And Elektra says, you know, I don't want your help. I need to understand this on my own. And if that changes or you're lying to me one way or the other, I'll find you. So Daredevil, for his part, follows her because he doesn't believe that he can let this go. Because again, at this time, he's still believing that this could be his daughter. So the other obvious question as Daredevil follows Elektra across the city is, who did she get the phone from, and why did they give it to her if there's nothing on it? Like, why did they trick her into thinking there was something on there, and why did she think there was something on the phone? So once Daredevil follows her to the guy who gave her the phone, we don't know who it is necessarily, but Daredevil eventually steps in as Elektra is interrogating this guy because Daredevil's worried that she's going to kill him. And Matt intervenes and knocks the side of her hand, telling her to stop. And Elektra says, how many chances do you think I'm prepared to give you, fool? Again, fully engaged in doing whatever it takes to find her daughter. So when the guy has a chance, the guy that gave Elektra the phone has a chance to actually speak, he says, the tangled web we weave. And that triggers something in Elektra, and she kind of collapses. And Daredevil understands now and confronts the guy, saying, what did you do to her? Tell me. And the guy's like, nothing. I swear, I'm just the messenger here. I was supposed to give her the phone. Somebody paid me to do it. And when she came back, I was supposed to say that to her. I don't know why, I swear. And he runs off with Daredevil realizing this was never about Elektra. It was actually an attack on Daredevil himself. And we don't find out who Daredevil thinks it is, but Elektra begins to regain consciousness, and she thinks the phrase, it unlocked my mind, it was all a lie. Somebody made me believe I had a daughter, but I never did. But they wanted me to feel that pain. And I didn't even know I could ever feel like that, you know, to give me a child and make me think I'd lost her. And she's crying. She's very emotional. And Daredevil tells Elektra how sorry he feels. And And in the end, Elektra is actually relieved. She says it was all a lie. Thank God. If there's no child, there's nobody for me to fail, right? Elektra feels like she's failed so many people in her life with the choices she's had to make. You know, her relationship with Matt Murdock was a casualty of that. You know, she wasn't able to save her father. And she ended up taking on the life and the mantle of an assassin. And in a way, she feels like she let herself down by doing that. But again, it was sort of a victim of circumstance sort of situation. So Elektra tells Daredevil, you know, there's no one to judge me. I'm free again. This is actually a happy ending. And Daredevil's thinking, I didn't do this to you, Elektra. I didn't do this, but it doesn't mean it's not my fault. Right. Matt feels that it's his fault. It's his relationship with Elektra that forced somebody to do this or allowed somebody to target Elektra like this to try to get to Daredevil himself. So for her part, once Elektra realizes this and Daredevil asks her what she's going to do, she says, well, I think, you know, nobody does this to me and gets away with it. I'm not going to let this stand. So she's going to keep hunting to find out who did this. It has moved from a hunt for the daughter that she didn't know she didn't have to a hunt for those responsible for putting her through this pain. So even though we get the end at the bottom of the last panel here, as Daredevil's thinking about how it's his fault, it's not really an end, right? We get a question mark because there's more to this story to still be told. So again, I think it's masterful storytelling from Charles Soule. He's subtly, you know, been planting the hints all along about the consequences of the choices Matt has made to make everybody forget that he's Daredevil. And he also does an incredible job of showing us the current state of the relationship between Elektra and Daredevil and Elektra and Matt Murdock, even to some extent, especially with this new status quo of the secret and the choices that Matt has made. And, you know, whatever he did to make everybody forget, it doesn't go by without a cost. Plus, Charles Soule is just really great at dialogue, right? And he always slips in at least a line or two that make me chuckle. In this issue, it's right after Elektra finds out from Daredevil that it was all a trick and a lie. There was nothing on the cell phone, and the cell phone itself, her one lead, got destroyed in the process of finding out that information. And again, just how much Daredevil's like, I knew how you were going to react to this, but I came anyway, and that shows that I'm on your side. And as Elektra takes off to go confront the guy that gave her the phone, Matt's first thought as he begins to follow her is, I think I almost died back there, but it was all I could think to do, right, is to tell her the truth. So that's great that Matt knew, Daredevil knew, man, I'm going to give her this news. And, you know, please don't kill the messenger, because he really was pretty close to that. And, I just love that line. It gave me a good chuckle. So, as far as the artwork goes, it's not as clean or as, visceral as when the regular series artist, Ron Garney draws the book, but it is pretty consistent. It's really close to the style that Ron uses when he draws it. So, and the other thing that adds a lot of consistency to the artwork is the color work from Matt Miller, who does the same amazing color work over Ron Garney's art as well. So that gives it some pretty good consistency, and it feels like the same kind of tone and mood that Garney's going for when he's on the book. So again, I know a lot of people thought that Soule's run was a bit of a slow burn. And I do feel like he is taking his time to really explore some of the aspects of Daredevil's choices and the consequences of his actions, both as a prosecutor and with making everybody forget that he was Daredevil, and also examining some things that maybe people haven't really examined before in terms of Daredevil is a blind guy, right? Yeah, he's a superhero, and yeah, he saves people, but there are struggles, right? There are things that he's not able to do. There are challenges that he has to face in unique ways because of his disability. And we saw that in the issue with Captain America, where Cap was talking to him. You know, Daredevil went to him for advice, and Cap's advice was look in the mirror and make sure you can, make sure you feel good about the reflection you see. You know, when you look at yourself, that'll tell you, well, that's not something Matt can do. A mirror to him is just a blank space. And in this issue, again, same thing with the phone. The phone to him is a flat piece of glass. It's just a blank slate. Being that the video had no sound, again, it's a unique challenge. So it's a way of really humanizing Daredevil in a way that we haven't seen before. I mean, he is a hero who's been through a lot, and he's certainly a hero that has been humanized and humbled through the various things that he's had to go through. But this is a new kind of perspective on that, and seeing that in a new way is, I think, at the heart of what Charles Soule is trying to do in this series. And so, again, I think it's very much worthy of the legacy of Daredevil, and it's certainly worth reading. So, especially now that it's been announced that Charles's run is coming to an end, I think that he did have a few more Daredevil stories that he wanted to tell. He wasn't completely done with the character, but it's not always up to the writers, obviously. The publishers had other ideas of a direction they wanted to go. So I'm kind of disappointed because I feel like Charles is, he's a lawyer himself. And based on the strength of these first seven issues, I feel like the guy was born to write Daredevil. And I don't know. I kind of wish that he'd gotten his chance to say everything that he wanted to with the character. But we've seen in the not so recent past, well, in the far past, I guess, with the character, and in the not so recent past, that some writers have had long runs on the character, left for a little while, and come back. We saw it with Frank Miller. We saw it with Brian Michael Bendis. So perhaps there's more Daredevil in Charles Soule's future. So, all right. I think that's going to do it, everybody. Thanks for joining me as always. Please tell your friends about us. Subscribe, rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on all those platforms, as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, please check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, I want to thank everybody for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.